News from NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta now offers a private dining room for parties, meetings, and other events. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff of The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. 1973, it was the year the Supreme Court decided Roe, the year the last U.S. combat troops were pulled out of Vietnam, the year of the Senate Watergate hearings and the OPEC oil embargo. For all the turmoil, there was also a great deal of creative energy in popular culture and in the arts. Historian Andreas Killen says 1973 was the pivotal year of the 1970s, a decade that he says served as an incubator for many of the developments that have helped shape who we are today. Andreas Killen is the author of the new book, 1973 Nervous Breakdown, Watergate, Warhol, and the Birth of Post-60s America. And he is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest, Andreas Killen, is an assistant professor of history at the City College of New York. In addition to 1973 Nervous Breakdown, he is the author of Berlin Electropolis. His writing has also appeared in Salon and the New York Times Magazine. His new book, 1973 Nervous Breakdown, is published by Bloomsbury. Professor Killen, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me on your show, Celeste.
My pleasure. Well, tell us about the critic Lester Bangs and how a review he wrote provided you with the title for this book.
Well, that's a good question. I had been sort of casting about for a title for some time. The original working title was a very dull one. It was just going to be 1973, a cultural history, but I wasn't happy with that, and my publisher wasn't happy with that. And I had been reading a lot of Lester Bangs' stuff. You know, he's a figure who crops up in a movie that I'm sure some of your listeners will be familiar with. It's Cameron Crowe's movie, Almost Famous. He's portrayed there as a sort of curmudgeonly music critic, which is what he was. So I stumbled across this review of his in the course of my readings. It's a review in which he completely pans the Rolling Stones album Goat's Head Soup, and it just seemed to capture for me the sense of, you know, social, and the title, 1973 Nervous Breakdown, seemed to capture for me the sense of social but also psychological crisis that, you know, seemed to me characteristic of this moment.
Yeah. What do you think of his twist on McLuhan's Global Village?
You mean the line that...
We're not a global village.
We are a global outpatient clinic.
Yeah.
you know, it's a great twist. It's a really great twist on it. I mean, I think he, you know, that comes actually from a review that appears later in the 1970s. And by that time, Bangs' perspective on things has become increasingly jaundiced. I mean, he is, you know, he's deeply kind of jaundiced observer of the American cultural scene. By the end of the 70s, he was really becoming very pessimistic about things. And I think it, you know, that line attests very much to this sense that as a result of the multiple converging crises of the late 60s and early 1970s, America had really, you know, it had lost its bearings, and was, you know, it was eligible for, you know, I mean, it needed to undergo major sort of rethinking of who it, you know, who it was and where it was going, and it had just all come apart as far as Bangs was concerned.
Yeah. Well, at the end of his quote is, "We're not a global village." The whole thing. We're not a global village. We're a global outpatient clinic, and the life force itself is most fully embodied in a frenetically twitching nerve.
Yeah.
You mentioned Bangs's jaundice, and that holds for today, I think, as well. The cynicism that we see today, we have twitching nerves as well.
It's true. I mean, that's certainly one of the reasons why I became interested in this period that I look at in the book, is because of the many parallels between that time and our time. I mean, many of the things that we're debating right now, on everything from the war in Iraq to, you know, abortion to whether the government has the right to spy on its civilians, can be traced back to debates that were held then in the wake of Vietnam and Watergate and Roe v. Wade. And I think the sense of crisis and malaise to some extent as well is every bit as intense in American society now as it was then.
Yeah, it is amazing to think how these things resonate with us today. To just take one issue, if I could call it that, Vietnam. In 1973, with the Paris Peace Accords, the withdrawal of combat troops, Operation Homecoming, which was POWs coming home, the war continues to resonate. It was an issue in the most recent presidential election. What are your thoughts about the role Vietnam played in that campaign?
Well, clearly, it, you know, the memory of the war, the sort of unresolved memory of the war, loomed very large in that campaign. It loomed large both in the candidacy of John Kerry, who went to Vietnam and came back a critic, and who first came to prominence as a very articulate critic of the war, whose criticism, you know, made him or earned him a place on Nixon's enemies list, to George Bush, who did not go to Vietnam, who avoided service, who signed up for, you know, the Air Force, but then, you know, in 1972 and 73, mysteriously disappeared or sort of left active duty under rather mysterious circumstances. So, in interesting way, I mean, it played out, the Vietnam thing, and the, you know, of course, the larger societal Vietnam thing, the so-called Vietnam syndrome, played itself out in the candidacies of these two figures in very interesting ways. I mean, you know, Kerry rightfully should have had his position, his service, and then his position on Vietnam should have given him the edge. But Bush was able to sort of pull the rug under from Kerry in a very clever way, and not just to neutralize Kerry's advantage, but to turn it against him.
Hmm. You know, I'm just curious if it was the 2004 campaign that got you thinking about the 1970s and inspired you to begin working on 1973 Nervous Breakdown.
No. My interest in that period predates the 2004 campaign.
When and how did it begin, your interest?
Well, I grew up in the 1970s. I mean, I'm very much a child of that decade. And, you know, for me, the 70s were it. You know, the pop culture of that period was mine. The movies, the music, the literature of that period. That's what I consumed. That was, you know, it was formative for me. And I grew up, you know, resenting being told that I had missed out on the 60s, that the 60s were the decade when, you know, things were really happening, and the 70s were the decade when nothing really happened. That's actually the title of one book about the decade. Nothing happened, or it seemed like nothing happened. You know, to me, that just totally missed the game. And so I wanted to sort of, you know, in part I conceived of the book as a kind of salvage operation. I wanted to rescue the period from the neglect that it had suffered from contemporaries and from historians. And, you know, then that also, as the war in Iraq got underway and people in the United States began thinking about and talking about the parallels between that war and Vietnam, and we began to see in this country some of the same kinds of politicization surrounding the war that manifested themselves in the 60s surrounding Vietnam, I became increasingly interested in the parallels between the two periods. Hmm. So, you know, I guess the answer to your question is that I became convinced as a member, as a child of the 70s, I wanted to flesh out the historical record, if you will. And I became convinced that if you wanted to understand that period, and indeed much of, you know, much of post-60s America, 1973 was a good place to start.
Hmm. Let's take some calls now. Our guest this afternoon, Andreas Killen, Assistant Professor of History at the City College of New York, the author of 1973 Nervous Breakdown, Watergate, Warhol, and the Birth of Post-60s America. First, we go to a listener in Chicago on line four. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. How are you?
Pretty good. I was just listening in, and one of the things that strikes me about what Dr. Killen's been saying and the subject of the book, which I have to confess I have not read yet, but I've been listening to the interview, is that it seems that there is sort of a bridge period of the 60s that he mentions that people have been telling him that he missed out on. And my question is, does this period of time in the 1970s represent sort of the end of that transitional period from out of the happy 50s into sort of the challenging of the 60s, or does it represent sort of the beginning of a new period of cynicism, which, I mean, I think very clearly is carried forward into today?
That's an excellent question. I think, you know, both, really. I mean, I think the 60s can be seen as having, you know, people date the end of the 60s very differently, depending on their perspective. Some people say, argue that it ended with the Manson murders in 1969. My own feeling is that it, you know, one can make the argument that it extended up until Nixon's reelection in 1972, and then the, you know, the end of the war and the return of the soldiers, which really took the wind out of the sails of, you know, the counterculture and of the anti-war movement. And that something new, but that at that moment something new is born, some kind of new political, cultural configuration is born, and it takes a while for it to become really quite clear what that new thing is. But it certainly, I think, in many ways, I think it is still with us today. And if I could just also say, it is a more cynical. I think you're right to say that one of the reactions to the 60s and to Watergate is a certain kind of cynicism and disenchantment. But I think coupled with that, there is also still a sense of optimism and promise and of new possibilities. It's very different in character from that of the 60s counterculture, but it is still there, mixed with that cynicism and sense of disenchantment.
Does a listener want to follow up?
No, I can't really argue with what he's saying. You know, one of the things that I thought has been very interesting about our current day situation is, as Dr. Killen mentions, there is that undeniable, I don't want to say it's a repeat, but a continuation of that cynicism, that relative distrust. And it'd be very easy to be overly partisan about it, but the fact of the matter is I think it's almost, you know, it's almost pan-political, it's across all the political parties.
Yeah, I think unfortunately that's true.
I want to thank the listener for his call. Next, we're going to talk with a listener in Champaign County, Line 1. Hi.
Good afternoon. Well, I like the idea of a collective nervous breakdown, actually. One of the things I think that should be mentioned, and it actually happened in 74, and I guess since you're talking about Watergate, you're including that, even though it's not exactly in the same. But the resignation of Nixon, and then what came out of that was sort of this, the president, we can't have another failed presidency, and it seems to be part of what put the Teflon on Ronald Reagan. So I think I see that as a very negative thing. But I'm wondering, in the actual calendar of 73, did you spend any time on the coup in Chile? Because that actually happened on 9/11 in 73. When people in Chile talk about 9/11, they have to ask which one they're talking about, because many people died, and the implications still redound to today, because you know, people like Kissinger has to be careful about where he travels, because he can be served at least a subpoena to testify about Pinochet and the whole thing. And it seems to me that in this era of, you know, rampant regime change, we should realize that it isn't particularly new. And that's some fodder for you, if you would.
Okay.
I'm getting a little bit of static on my end of the line, but...
You talk about Allende and the coup.
Yes, definitely. I there is a brief discussion in my book in one of my chapters about the events in Chile and the American involvement in those events. I wasn't, unfortunately, able to spend as much time, for reasons of time, I wasn't able to spend as much time as I would have liked to, looking into that and writing about it. But it is definitely there as part of the larger, you know, political backdrop to the events that I discuss in my book. It comes up in the context of a discussion of a particular movie that appeared in that year, the Costa Gavras film State of Siege, which is actually set in Uruguay, but parallels or foreshadows in a number of kind of eerie ways events that play themselves out in Chile on September 11th, 1973, as you quite rightly point out. So, yes.
And any thought about the resonance of what happened in Chile in 73 with how we talk about regime change today?
Yeah. Well, it seems to be a lesson that America never quite really learned, that America's efforts to engage in regime change in various times and places, have never really worked out quite as envisioned. In fact, often they've misfired quite drastically, and that, you know, that is a lesson that, I mean, the country learned many lessons from what happened in Vietnam and Watergate and from some of the other events that take place during this period, but the possibility for unfortunate consequences arising out of efforts to intervene in or reshape or manipulate political events outside the United States elsewhere has not been learned very well, I would say.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Eureka, line 3. Go ahead.
A comment and a question. May Dr. Kissinger be subpoenaed, please? The question would be, it seems like we're not done with the 60s, and if you look at any number of issues such as individualism versus community, consumerism, materialism versus simpler lifestyle, environmental concerns, a kind of maybe moral anarchism versus a search for genuine morality and ethical values and a relationship to the nation state, we're still being... those issues are still going through the culture. Your comment, please.
Yes, well, clearly the 1960s and the 1970s, I would add, opened up a whole Pandora's box of issues that we are still working our way through, that are still working their way through our cultural bloodstream, and we have yet to come to grips with many of them, from abortion to gay rights to, presidential power and the limits to it. All of these, you know, were part of the cultural gestalt of that period, and they're still very much alive with us today.
One more comment. I'm glad you wrote your book, and I think your mention of Kerry's debate about the Vietnam War is just another example of all that unfinished business.
Yes, there's a tremendous amount of unfinished business.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other telephone calls are welcome if you would like to join the discussion this afternoon. Give us a call with a question, comment, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, professor of history at the City College of New York, Andreas Killen, author of 1973 Nervous Breakdown, Watergate, Warhol, and the Birth of Post-60s America. The book takes a look at the decade of the 1970s. You know, it's interesting, in the book's second chapter, Reality Programming, you describe 1973 as the beginning of the so-called culture wars. Would you talk about what seemed to be the implosion of the family that seemed to be underway in the 1970s?
Well, there was I guess you could call it a generalized sense that the family as a kind of bastion, a central institution of American society, was under attack on a number of different fronts as a result of, say, the sexual revolution launched by the pill, as a result of women moving into the workforce, as a result of a general sort of relaxation of sexual mores and a sort of reexamination of relations between men and women, parents and children, and so forth that had been forced by the upheavals of the 1960s. And this culminates in the early 70s with, you know, some alarming statistics about divorce, for instance, or about the decline of the nuclear family. And in 1973, it kind of comes to a head with the passage of with the Roe v. Wade decision handed down by the Supreme Court in January of that year, which, you know, is the result of a protracted, ongoing debate and conflict that extends throughout much of the 60s and culminates in this rather surprising decision that is handed down. And at the time, it was greeted by many or seen by many as an opportunity to sort of lay to rest the decision. Well, as we now know, that it did far from that. It turned it into really, unquestionably the central issue in these ongoing culture wars that have convulsed American society over the last 30 years.
Yeah. It was center stage again just recently with the nominations and confirmation hearings for Justices Roberts and Alito. Where do you think the court's headed on the issue?
I think that is a really interesting question. I think it's very hard to say what's going to happen next. Certainly, you know, the sort of the pro-life, the radicals in the pro-life movement see this as a great coup, as an opportunity to finally, you know, overturn Roe v. Wade. And it's conceivable that that may happen. But I also think that there are, others within the Republican Party, more moderates, if you will, who are extremely wary about that possibility. I mean, the abortion issue energizes their constituency like no other single issue. And I think that they're to some extent a little bit nervous about what would happen if that issue disappeared, and if the, you know, the enormous revenue streams that are driven by that issue were to suddenly dry up as a result of the Supreme Court decision. So I think it's a little hard to say, and perhaps a little too early to say how it's all gonna play out. But I think there are forces on both sides who basically want the status quo to remain in place, and would be very, very concerned. Clearly, I mean, that's true for the pro-choice forces are very nervous about that. But I think there are also, you know, people within the Republican Party who are also somewhat nervous about where all this may lead.
Let's take another phone call. A listener in Indiana, line 4, hi.
Hello?
Hi there.
I guess this has been very interesting to me, especially for someone who says that he grew up in the 70s. I guess I'd have to say I grew up in the 50s, graduating in 57, entered school and graduate school. So the 60s were, you know, dead on with me. I've, through my listening to different programs and reading things, for example, like New York Review books and things like that about the people coming back to reflect upon the 60s, I'm sort of interested in what you might say about New York City in the 50s as a progenitor of all this, and of course you'd have to throw in Berkeley eventually on this free speech problems. That kind of cast a shadow for me. I don't exactly how to, you know, to put it in, like, especially like a novel or anything like that, but I just think there's a very interesting, and maybe a movie could take care of it, but there's a very interesting thing that was going on downtown New York City, so to speak, that certainly blossomed in the 60s. Corso, Ginsberg, a number of poets were very influential in some of the things they tried to get done, especially in Great Rides. Mm-hmm. I just wonder if you could talk about that in terms of the historical content. Thanks.
Right. Well, I'm not exactly sure how to tackle that question. I mean, it certainly, you know, by the early 70s, you know, the Beat movement has all but disappeared, I would say, really. I mean, Ginsberg is still he's still an important presence. And Burroughs, of course, as well. I mean, one area in which one can see their influence making itself felt, I would say, is in the earliest stirrings of punk music. I mean, people like Patti Smith and the members of the band Television were all directly influenced by the poetry of and writing of people like Burroughs and Ginsberg. And so one can establish, if you will, a certain kind of lineage leading from the Beats of the 50s to the musicians, particularly the punk scene of the 1970s, which clearly it's very much rooted in New York City and in downtown New York City. There are some more important continuities there.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Also, you know, the caller mentioned literature. Film, John Updike's Rabbit novels spring to mind here in terms of, you know, Harry Rabbit Engstrom living through the 50s, 60s, 70s, and I haven't read the last novel in the series, but there are four of them, but I think that takes us into the 80s. There we have in Rabbit somebody who is, you know, perhaps we could say he's a member of the silent majority, and we see him coping with this great half century of change.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've read any of those.
I must confess that I've only read one or two of those books, and it was a long
time. Yeah, it's been a while.
It's been a long time, so I'm afraid I couldn't say anything very intelligent about them, about how they figure within all of this. He was not somebody I looked at in the course of writing this book.
And also one wonders if Updike was trying to digest, to pull things together from this post-war period, the latter half of the 20th century.
Very likely. I mean, I think a lot of the writers of this period are, in fact, trying to do that. Pynchon comes to mind. Philip Roth comes to mind. They are all, you know, they're all in one way or another. Vonnegut comes to mind. They're all in one way or another reacting to the sort of splitting apart of the great consensus that was formed in this country after World War II during the 1950s that really began to unravel in the 1960s.
Do you think by the 1970s there was a nostalgia for the 1950s?
Oh, very much so, very much so. The huge nostalgia industry is being born at precisely this moment, and you can point to the influence of a movie like American Graffiti, George Lucas's American Graffiti, which is the sort of surprise smash hit of the summer of 1973, which looks back to and attempts to sort of recuperate the 1950s as this mythic age of lost American innocence, if you will.
Yeah.
It sets it Actually, it's set in 1962, right? You know, so right on the eve of the Vietnam War, and it, you know, it, and out of that, of course, you know, you get the TV show Happy Days with Ron Howard. One of the starring roles. Ron Howard is, you know, he plays a key role in American Graffiti, and he goes on to star in Happy Days for many years. So, yeah, and then, you know, there are other American films of this period. Look back to earlier periods, to the 30s, the Way We Were, The Sting. There is a great deal of nostalgia. And within that, the 50s play a particularly important, one might even say privileged, role.
Mm. Well, you mentioned Happy Days. Well, the show that comes to my mind is The Brady Bunch.
Right.
Where we have an update of the family of the 50s. We have a blended family. But it's all, you know, it's all very comfortable and sugary sweet.
Exactly.
Oh.
Exactly. And the TV show that I pay most attention to in my book is the series that aired in the winter of 1973 called An American Family, the first example of reality television programming, which was conceived very much as a sort of answer to the somewhat anodyne vision of family life that one finds in a show like The Brady Bunch. A totally fascinating experiment in which this family, the Loud family of Santa Barbara, California, invited television cameras into their home for a period of several months and allowed themselves to be filmed and recorded as they went about their everyday lives. And then the show aired that winter in a series of, I think, 11 episodes. It was a huge media event. Got a lot of attention, and you know,
and people essentially saw this family disintegrate.
Yeah, well, that's the interesting thing.
Yeah.
I mean, in the course of the series, the marriage falls apart. The older son comes out of the closet, announces he's gay, and moves to New York to live in the Chelsea Hotel. And I mean, this sort of idyllic image that the family had carefully tried to construct of itself falls apart under the eye of the camera, and it's very ugly, and it makes for very compelling TV drama.
And interestingly enough, the father, I don't recall, I have not seen the series, I never saw it, but the father, at one point in the series, they're in New York City, and they go to a Warhol exhibition, and he talks about Warhol as a father.
it's, yeah, what happens is Lance Loud, the teenage son, who comes out of the closet, moves to New York, moves into the Chelsea Hotel, and falls in with the Warhol crowd. I think it's Holly Goodlawn is living in the Chelsea Hotel, and you see a few scenes of her in them. It turns out that Lance Loud has, since the age of 12 or 13, been corresponding with Warhol. He read about him in Time magazine and immediately sent him a letter, and eventually they correspond with each other, and they talk over the phone. And so when Lance moves to New York, his mother, it's actually his mother, comes to visit him there. And at one point, he takes his mother to, I guess it's the Whitney, to see a Warhol retrospective. And so you see them walking through the museum, and the walls are covered with these images of, you know, Campbell soup cans and you know, Marilyn and Jackie O's faces and so forth. And it's this, and Lance is quoted in one interview subsequently. He's quoted as saying that Warhol, for members of his generation, Warhol was a kind of paternal figure, that he served as a sort of substitute father, if you will. He adopted these kind of misfits and strays, people like Lance himself, and took them under his wing and encouraged them. Lance subsequently went on to write for Warhol's magazine Interview, wrote a column.
Thanks for being so kind with my error there. I must have just been speeding past, speeding along on my reading. But I thought it was the father. But it makes sense that it would be Lance Loud, not Lance's father.
Right.
And here we have a perfect opportunity now to talk about gay rights.
Mm-hmm.
In 1973, the American Psychiatric Association announced it no longer considered homosexuality a mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
What does this decade and that act provide us in terms of insight into the current debate about gay marriage?
Well, it certainly puts it on the agenda. Gay rights becomes one of the big issues of the 1970s, one of the big rallying cries of this period. I mean, I think for gays, the period between the Stonewall riots of 1969 and then the onset of AIDS in the 1980s, that you know, more or less 10-year-long period represents, in retrospect at least, a kind of golden age, an age of relative, you know, freedom. They're allowed to, you know, the American Psychiatric Association at one stroke, you know, lifts the stigma of being gay from millions of Americans. So this is a moment of tremendous liberation for gays. But already you see in this sort of cauldron of this cultural cauldron that is forming the beginnings of a reaction against this phenomenon, just as you see the beginnings of a coordinated reaction against women's rights and against abortion and so forth. So, it again, that this is a sort of moment of crystallization when abortion and gay rights and other issues related to, you know, sex and gender gets put on the table. And again, we're clearly living with the consequences of that now.
And we're still asking ourselves the question, what is it to be a family? And also now we have added to the mix technological breakthroughs in terms of when and, you know, we've gone way beyond the pill now. We have technologies that can help women become pregnant, and we have sperm banks and so on and so forth. Back to an American family. We don't have a whole lot of time left here. I think one of the things that you said about an American family that was really interesting was it was a response to the nation's reality deficit.
Mm-hmm.
You want to talk about that?
Yeah. you know, I think an American family was interesting on a number of different levels. One of the things that made it so interesting was that it represented an effort on the part of TV to respond to a certain kind of anxiety or concern that TV was to some extent responsible for a kind of reality deficit on the part of Americans. Namely, in other words, that so many Americans were watching so much TV that they were, you know, becoming to some extent unable to distinguish between what they saw on the television set and real life. This could work in a number of different ways. What the producers of the show American Family did was to try to, you know, reinvent TV as a way to restore American sense of reality, to begin to, you know, to try to tear down some of those false images of family life that shows like Ozzie and Harriet and a Brady Bunch and so forth were seen as responsible for having created. But I think it's, you know, this is a period in which people's perceptions of and anxieties about the power of the media in American life are also beginning really to crystallize. I mean, as a result of the Vietnam War and as a result of the Watergate hearings, TV acquired enormous new kind of cultural authority. And this was welcomed by many, but it was also seen as part of a larger problem that many people had serious misgivings about.
Hmm. Reality television, the Senate Watergate hearings.
Yeah, there's a very interesting convergence there of these two events.
Yeah. Before we have to wrap up, I want you to tell us where Richard Nixon uttered that sentence, "I am not a crook."
Yeah, he uttered that at Disney World in Florida, of all places.
Oh boy!
In the midst of a press conference, I think he was answering questions about not actually about Watergate, but about his tax returns. There's some questions arose in the fall of 1973 about his tax filings, and so he was forced to take some rather difficult questions about that and. At this press conference that he gave in Disney World, in I believe November, he uttered this famous line. Hmm. I am not a crook.
Last question. We have to wrap up. What would you like to say at the end here about what happened to the left and its political vision in the decade of the 70s?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is in some ways. One of the most interesting questions that I was trying to deal with in my book. I mean, the second half of the 60s and the early part of the 70s was a moment of intense politicization. People, you know, millions of ordinary Americans were caught up in the anti-war movement and in a sort of larger, more inchoate wish for change of some sort. 1970, 1971, the largest anti-war demonstrations of the entire period. By 1972, 1973, the anti-war movement has just completely fizzled out, disintegrated. To the extent that it remains alive in a much more radicalized and violent form in the activities of groups like the Symbionese Liberation Army, the organization that kidnapped Patty Hearst in the winter of 1974. It seems as though the sort of intense expectations and aspirations for change. You know, they ran into a kind of wall at some point, And when it became clear that the American people were simply not ready for this vision of radical social change, it was groups like the SLA that attempted, in a certain sense, to force the issue by resorting to violence, resorting to spectacular deeds in order to re-energize the American public. And the consequences of that, I think, were rather unfortunate.
There we have to leave it. Andreas Killen, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Our guest this afternoon, Andreas Killen, author of 1973 Nervous Breakdown, Watergate, Warhol, and the Birth of Post-60s America. And that was from the archive, and boy, we dropped out there, didn't we? This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Andreas Killen's book, 1973, Nervous Breakdown, published by Bloomsbury, that interview from April 12th of last year, 2006. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Let's find out what happened today in Kansas City and in Chicago at the Boards of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. In Chicago, futures in the wheat pit dragged lower today. In Kansas City, futures were down as well. They were down 14.5 cents and thereby there at $7.62. In July, the harvest month for the hard red, down a dime at $6.82. In Chicago, at the CME Group, the nearby December, a $7.48 settlement price, 13 cents lower for the December contract. $7.65 was the top. The bottom was at $7.45.5, so a 19.5 cent trading range, down 13 for the day at $7.48 for the December soft red winter wheat. March futures, $7.86, the high, the low at $65.25. Settlement price at $7.69, 12.5 lower. And the May futures is $7.70.75, top bottom at $51.5. A settlement price there at $7.53.5, finished 14 cents lower. July contract down 14.5 at $6.61.5 for the new crop soft red winter wheat. The harvest month had a high of 76.5 and a low at 660. Once again, the settlement price at 661.5, down 14.5. September futures, 682.25, the high. The low at $6.69.5. Settlement price at 671.75, down 11.75 for the soft red winter wheat. Now from the corn pit in Chicago, the Board of Trade, December futures, 4.25 lower. 382 the high, the low at 74. Settlement price, 0.75 cents above the low at $3.74.75, down 4.25 on the afternoon. March contract, 399 the high, the low at 91. Settlement price at $3.92, down 4. And the May futures were down 4 as well at 4.02 1/4. Their top at 409, the bottom at 401 3/4. July futures, 417 the high, the low at 409 3/4. July corn settled 4.5 cents lower at $4.10.5 a bushel, and the September's were down 4.25 at 414.5, with a top at 20.5 and a low at 414.5 for the SEP. December futures next year, 426 the high, the low at 420, settled just above the bottom of that 6 cent trading range at $4.20 3/4 of a cent. They were down 3 3/4 for next year's December futures in the corn pit. The March contract, 431 the high, the low at 26. Settlement price at 427, down 3.5, and May 09 at 431 in the corn pit, down 3.5 cents for the day. December oat futures at 288 3/4 high, low at 81.5. Settlement price at 286.5, up 1 for the day. And the March futures down 0.25 at 299 3/4, the high at 302, the low at 295. November soybean futures, $10.49 the high, low at 1031.5. Settlement price at 1044 1/4. Up 11.5 for the day. January futures, 1062 1/4 the high, the low at 44 1/4. Settlement price at 1056 1/4, a dime higher. And the May contract, 1080 the high, the low at 1063. Settled at 1074.5, up a dime. July futures, 1082 the high, the low at 1065. Settlement price at 1076 1/2. And they settled a dime higher. August futures, 1062 the high, the low at 51. Settlement price at $10.60, up 9. And September's, 1028.5 the high, the low at 18.5. Settlement price at $10.22, up 14. November's, $9.99.5 the high, the low at 980. Settlement price at 994.5, 11 3/4 cents higher. That for the November 2008 soybean contract. December bean meal futures now, 286.90 the high, the low at 280. Settlement price at 285, up 490. January up 540 at 287 for the afternoon. December bean oil futures 44.95 the high, the low at 44.11. Settlement price at 44.23, down 23. And January futures 30 lower at 44.58. That's a look at the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade. We'll get those from the Mercantile Exchange, all from the CEME Group in just a moment. Reminder to stay with us this afternoon during the closing market report. We'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of Newmarket, Indiana, and have our regular Tuesday energy analyst along. Harry Cooney will join us from GrowMark in Bloomington this afternoon. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
3 minutes before 2 o'clock, let's turn our attention now to what happened today in Chicago at the Mercantile Exchange with the livestock contracts. December live cattle, 95.90 the high, 95.15 the low, 95.57 and a half the settlement, that up 47 and a half. February, 98.47 and a half the high, 97.75 the low, 98.37 and a half the settlement, that up 42 and a half. April, 98.80 the high, 98.20 the low, the settlement, 98.45, that finishing down 2.5. June, 94.07 and a half the high, 93.65 the low, 93.92 and a half the settlement, that up 20. November feeder cattle, 108.90 the high, 108.50 the low, 108.90 the settlement, that up 47 and a half. January, 109.80 the high, 108.85 the low, the final 109.25, that up 27 and a half. March, 109.80 the high, 109 even the low, 109.55 the settlement, that up 20. April feeder cattle, 111.50 the high, 110.80 the low, 111.45 the settlement, that up 30. Lean hogs finished higher on the day today. December, 54.30 the high, 52.50 the low, 54.05 the settlement, that up 150. February, 61.25.